Our special guest today is Ethan Block. Is that how you say your name?
That's exactly.
And it's spelled E-T-H-A-N-B-L-O-C-H?
Yep.
Where do you live, Ethan?
San Francisco.
And briefly, what's your professional background?
Entrepreneur, maybe the easiest way to describe it. Just been starting projects and businesses since I was about 13.
And is it currently involved in any internet enterprise?
Yep.
And are you doing coding, actually making products and services on a computer?
Yeah, so my most recent project, I'm spending the majority of my time right now coding. In the past, I actually am not an engineer trade or by school, and so it's really all self-taught. And I used to manage people that would write most of the code, and I made it a priority to actually learn how to code myself.
What machine and what software are you using to code?
I use a MacBook Air using a language called Node.js.
Can you spell that for us?
Node.js.
And how is that different from anything else that people have heard about?
The language itself?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a rather new language. It's maybe 3 or 4 years old. And the syntax is JavaScript, which most people are familiar with as being what happens on a web page. You know, you click a button and some action happens. Usually it's driven by JavaScript, and that's what's called front end. You know, you're on a web page, it's what you see as a user. And Node actually uses JavaScript on the back end. So what's processing on the server side. So after you may click a button and some JavaScript generates some action you see, like you delete an item, on the back end, when the item's actually deleted from the database, that would be Node operating that transaction.
So none of us would ever know Node even existed in real life.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, unless you were geeky, nerdy, or an engineer.
Are there any existing sites that we could look at that are Node sites, or is that irrelevant to the user?
I don't know if it's irrelevant. So there are a few big web scale applications that are using Node. Typically though, you know, you'll see more Ruby on Rails, you'll see Python, you'll see PHP going back to like Yahoo and Facebook. And, you know, Google uses a whole array of things, Java, C++, mm-hmm. Python.
And is the Mac able to do this high-end coding?
Oh yeah. I mean, so the Mac, because the Mac is based on, you know, really what's Unix architecture, it's very easy to use any of these languages or frameworks on a Mac. Much actually easier than, people may disagree with me, much easier than on a Windows machine.
Did you buy a book? How did you learn? Did you go to a YouTube tutorial? Do you go to a camp someplace?
Yeah, that's a great question. So again, for me, I was somewhat technical before this, but never had written like an application, you know, full scale application that worked. And the way I learned was a site called Code Academy, which is free and available to anyone. You go on and they have JavaScript lessons where it's actually as if you're working with a teacher, but it's a machine. Hmm. And you go through all these lessons, and there's tons of great lessons written by other programmers that they put on there. And so that's how I got my base sort of JavaScript knowledge. And then from that, you build things and you break things and you hack things together, and you spend a lot of time Googling on how to do things. And you take other people's code and you put it in and you wonder why it doesn't work. But Code Academy is incredible. I would have learned otherwise, but not nearly as quickly.
What do they get out of it?
Their startup, they were what's called a Y Combinator company. So they were, you know, incubated in a sense. And I think, they don't charge, but I'm sure there's something in their roadmap to either distribute it to schools or have some paid lesson plans or something like that.
Well, once you're all done, do you have something on your screen that actually has dots and clicks and pops and stuff like that?
Me?
I mean, when you're doing this back-end coding, or is it so geeky that if the average person looked at it, it would just look like complete gibberish?
Well, if you looked at the code itself, it would look, you know.
No, I mean, when you run it, after you actually turn it, does it end up being an interface product?
Well, it depends what you're doing. In my case, yeah, I mean, on the front end, the pages generate, you know, their HTML. And so you have that full kind of stack where you have, you know, an HTML page that some data gets pushed to that Node grabs from a database in the background. So when a user requests a page, Node serves the page, and whatever you see on the page came from a database, right, that Node also grabbed and served to the page itself. Okay. And so in my case, you could see it in a web browser, but you could use Node to write scripts. So, you know, you would see it in like a terminal or something like mm-hmm. that on your Mac. You could go into your terminal and you could run like a little Node script and it could perform some action.
Okay, well, let's take a break and talk about your personal technology. Do you use an iPhone?
Yep.
And which one do you have?
iPhone 5.
What sort of case do you use?
No case.
Why not?
I personally believe that it's made to not have a case. It's gorgeous. I mean, they spent so much time building one of the most beautiful devices in the world that I think it's upsetting to put it in a case.
And what color iPhone do you have?
Black.
And which model do you have? Verizon, AT&T?
Verizon.
Okay, why Verizon?
AT&T is awful in San Francisco. So we originally had AT&T, my fiance and me, and we switched to Verizon. I think around the iPhone 4S, we switched to Verizon.
Mm-hmm. Well, AT&T is notoriously problematic in the city of San Francisco.
Yes, yeah, so bad.
Now, what headphones do you use with your iPhone 5?
So I use two. I use the earbuds that come with it, and then I have a pair of Audio-Technica 150MS, I believe is the model number, for music or other things. I also use this on the computer.
Are those earbuds?
No, they're over the ear.
Okay, and do you recommend those Audio-Technica?
They're great.
How much do they cost?
$120.
Okay, what's
I
that?
Did a ton of research on forums, and for, you know, I'm not like a crazy audiophile, but for a base set for $120, it's like the best bang for your buck over the ear type headphone.
Now, do you also have an iPad?
Yep, I got the iPad Mini.
Why the Mini?
Well, I had an iPad, and I used it mainly to watch Netflix, probably. And I just didn't find myself picking it up that much. I went to the Apple Store and picked up the Mini and was instantly like, holy cow, this is great. I literally said that, this is great. And a guy I was with was laughing at me because he's like, you haven't even done anything yet. You just picked it up. And then I bought one, you know, a few days later, and I find myself using it all the time. Just the difference in weight and size for me. You know, I'm not tiny, but I'm not a big guy or have huge hands.
Yeah.
And so it's so much more manageable and easy to use. And yeah, I don't know. I love it.
Now, did you get a case for that?
I got the smart cover that Apple sells.
And do you use different headphones with that or the same one?
Same. Use the earbuds or use the Audio-Technicas, depending on what I'm doing.
Which model of iPad Mini did you get?
Just the 16 gig black Wi-Fi. Good.
Okay. Wi-Fi only.
You Wi-Fi only.
$300 and change, you're done.
$329 or whatever it was. Well, I can tether to my iPhone. So if I really need internet and I don't have Wi-Fi, I can open up an access point on the iPhone. And
tell us how that works.
So if you have, and I don't know all services provided, but certainly on Verizon, if you have, you know, any kind of data plan, you can turn on tethering. So if you go into your settings and click on, I think it says personal hotspot is what it's called.
Mm-hmm.
You click that and you can actually turn on an access point where any other device, laptop, desktop, iPad, can connect to it as if it's another Wi-Fi access point and access the web.
So the source data stream is coming from the phone?
That's right.
And does that accelerate the depletion of your allotment
data
of
plan?
Yes.
Sure does. So Verizon loves it.
How does that work? What does it mean in real life?
For me, you know, we only get, I think we get 4 or 5 gigs a month in data. And for me, you know, we never cross it. So it doesn't really hurt us by tethering. Good. I can see if you're, you know, if you're streaming video and not just YouTube, but let's say something from like the iTunes store.
Yeah.
You know, some 720 or 1080 video, mm-hmm. then you might crush your data plan.
Now, is the same MacBook Air that you're using for your professional coding work, is that the same computer you use for personal?
Yeah, it's my go-to. It's my all-around computer.
So which Air do you have?
I got it. I don't know the model number, but I got it last year. It's when they first came out with the newest version of the Air. So the model, the body. So the body that's the thinnest they've ever had.
13-inch, not the
13-inch, exactly. 13-inch MacBook Air, solid-state hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. It's the best computer I've ever owned, actually.
Now, do you use the scratch and sniff trackpad for mousing and for clicking, or do you use an external mouse and keyboard?
If I'm traveling or if I'm somewhere on the couch, I'll just use what comes with the computer, right? The keyboard and the scratch and sniff trackpad. Now, when I'm at my desk, I plug into a Thunderbolt display. I plug into the Bluetooth keyboard. And then I actually have some older, I think it's a Logitech wireless optical mouse that I use. And I also have the Magic Trackpad. Depending what I'm doing, I'll rotate one or the other in or out.
But is coding all text, just typing in text?
So my time, if you break it down, is probably spent 60% of the time on Google trying to figure out how to do things or why something's broken, which is great. And then, you know, 30% of the time is probably spent writing, editing, fixing some line of code, and then maybe even be a little bit less, and then the rest is actually seeing what you're doing in the browser.
Mm-hmm.
So if, you know, or in the script itself, hitting refresh a lot, making sure things turn out, you know, and if you're getting the result that was intended.
Now, as you finish the code, or if you finish these little samples and snippets, are they automatically being backed up and archived somewhere, so in case you have a crash or a catastrophe or a fire or a flood, you haven't lost your work?
That's a great question. It's actually something called GitHub.
How do you spell it?
GitHub. And it's what's called a code repository in the cloud. And they've been around since, I think, 2007 or 2006. And it's great. And so if you write some code and you're done, it's good. You basically commit whatever you just changed or added to GitHub. And you just push it into the cloud. And it's all stored. So I can access my code from any device or any computer in the world. I can share it easily with someone. I can give you access. You can mm-hmm. download my code on your computer.
So it's analogous to having an iCloud account
yeah.
for my text edit that I type my documents
exactly
and then
right.
pick or pages or whatever.
That's exactly
Same
right.
sort of thing.
Just much easier to share.
And what about physical backups? How are you physically backing up your data on your vulnerable MacBook Air?
So I'm a heavy user of Dropbox. I have...
A paid Dropbox account?
Oh, yeah. I've been a paid member for
You've gone
years.
Over 2 gigabytes?
Oh, yeah. I think I'm at 60 gigabytes, roughly.
Okay, so you're probably on the 100 gigabyte
That's
plan.
Right. Yeah, the 100 gigabyte
So you're giving plan. Them a couple $100 a year.
I think it's $120 a year.
And you can load stuff up there, whatever you need.
It's incredible.
Have you ever had a major physical data loss or a major crash where you wanted to just
Kill
go
myself.
Go back to bed and wish the day hadn't started?
Not since 2007. I had a MacBook then in the hard drive after 364 days. I remember because I wrote a blog post about it. 364 days after I bought it, the hard drive just stopped working. With the MacBook Air, you know, when you switch to a solid state drive, there's so much less that could ever go wrong with your hard drive that mm-hmm. failure rate's just way lower. And so I haven't had any catastrophe. When you switch to a new computer, right, which could be
yes.
the equivalent, then... I always start fresh. I connect my Dropbox account and I leave it for mm-hmm. 24 hours to download everything and reset it up, install my applications and such.
So you don't have a physical hard drive that you're backing up to using Time Machine or Carbon Copy Cloner or Super
no.
Duper?
So what I do is everything that I keep on my laptop, which is pretty much files, photos, code, is all backed up either through Dropbox or in the code case GitHub.
Mm-hmm.
Then I have video. So when I shoot video or from, you know, I've been shooting video since I was like 13.
Mm-hmm.
I actually have an external NAS server,
mm-hmm.
which is, I forget the name of the company, always evades me. But I basically have 2 1-terabyte mirrored drives or 2 2-terabyte mirrored drives. And so that is where my video is.
Oh, I
and
see.
So that's mirrored on 2 drives. And so when I shoot new video, I'll move it to those drives.
What's the video of? What's the subject?
Personal stuff, largely.
What camera are you using?
So I've used an array of cameras, from those big cameras you used to put on your shoulder that would take a VHS tape, to the, what was it called, the flip camera. Shot a lot of video on. My friends bought me a camcorder, I forget when, you know, it was a mini DV or mini HD or whatever mm-hmm. that was. And then I use my iPhone largely now, which is shoots great video.
Are you doing immediately after that, uploading that to Dropbox using the cloud uploader?
Yeah.
Using the Dropbox app on the phone?
Yeah, that's right. So if I'm on a Wi-Fi connection, I'll just let Dropbox sync photos and video I'm taking as I'm taking it to Dropbox.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll grab it and I'll move it to my NAS server when I'm home.
Is there a time that you're going to run out of space on the small hard drive
on the
MacBook Air?
So I used to run out a lot because I used to keep a lot of my video on there. Now I've moved my video off and I think I have a 150 or I don't remember off the top of my 250 mm-hmm. gigabyte drive and I have plenty of space free.
But what about the loss of settings or applications or email or all that sort of stuff that's just living there on your computer ready for somebody to pour some boiling hot oil or drop it in your bathtub or...
Yeah. So in terms of...
A lightning strike.
I don't mind the settings that much just because I actually kind of like having to do my settings all over again on a new computer because maybe I'll get rid of some old habits and acquire some new
uh-huh.
ones. In terms of the applications I use something called I Use It or I Use This, which allows you to tell it what apps you use. And it has another corresponding app which will actually upload and tell it what apps you're using automatically. And so I know exactly what apps I'm using. And so if I get a new computer or the computer dies, I know what apps to download.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of settings, I just it's nice because you kind of, you'll be tackling some problem and you'll set some setting that you don't actually ever need again. And so it's kind of like a reset when you start like on a new computer where you kind of set your settings as you need them, which I like.
Okay, so let's go for part three. Let's talk about some advice for young entrepreneurs or people getting started in coding. We've talked about the online coding workshop. What about for people who have a good idea? I got a good idea. I'm a young person. I'm smart. I'm in or out of high school or college or whatever. I've got a little bit of funding. I worked as a job at a job, so I've got some money. How do you become an entrepreneur? What sort of advice do you have for young potential entrepreneurs?
Sure. So I have two big pieces of advice. One is, if your idea is even the slightest bit technical, when I say technical, I mean web related or mobile related or some sort of piece of software, I would suggest that you learn how to build a prototype yourself. I think
don't outsource it.
Yeah, I've seen some successes, but the vast majority are failures. If you are going to build a technical company, I would advise you to have technical talent, or you're picking the wrong industry to be in.
As opposed to being a plumber.
Yeah, or any, or I mean, there's tons of ventures, right? You're going to open up a store. You're going to open up an e-commerce store. Yeah. You're going to create a product and sell it. You're going to write a book. You're going to, you know, sell advice. You're going to consult. There's tons and tons of, you know, businesses where they're not technical and they're great businesses. Mm-hmm. But if it's a technical business, I'd advise you to have some technical talent. Otherwise, I think you're probably picking the wrong line of business.
Okay, so that's part one.
That's part one. And then part two is start now. Like, stop waiting. The stars will never align. Nothing will ever be perfect. And the quicker you start building whatever's in your head, the faster you'll really start making progress. I mean, that sounds so simple, but a lot of people keep putting these roadblocks in their heads. Oh, I don't start because I don't get enough time off work. I don't start because I have to do this on the weekends. I would say stop freaking watching TV, right? I'm sure there's some of that. Or like, there is almost no reason, if you really are passionate about some product or idea, that you haven't already started. So I would say go and start. Move as quickly as you can.
What about being undercapitalized?
In this day and age, especially if you're building something for the web, you don't really need any capital. It's almost all free, or at least what I call credit cardable, meaning if you have any kind of credit card, any service, whether you're going to be, you know, using GitHub for your code or using Heroku for hosting or Amazon or whatever, like, you can put it on a credit card. There's we're not in a world anymore where you need to drop a couple $100,000 for some Oracle license and a couple $100,000 for some servers that you need to keep in your house. None of that exists anymore.
What about bank loans and small business administration and that conventional funding?
I don't think again, it depends what you're doing. If your business is capital intensive, like you're going to open up a store, an e-commerce store or something, then maybe you need a lot of money. But otherwise, I can't imagine you couldn't get a web application started for less than $1,000.
And how useful is it to outsource, and how useful is it to compartmentalize and have other people be part of it, as opposed to trying to take it on yourself and driving your friends, your parents, your girlfriend, your siblings crazy?
I think it depends on the business. There are a lot of great one-person businesses where you can make a great living and do something you love, and you can do almost everything yourself and maybe outsource some of the small things, not the core aspects of the business, but maybe it's the support, maybe it's the, you know, marketing, maybe it's these items that you could possibly outsource. And those are for the one-person businesses. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're building a business that will require more than a few people, then you'll need to know basically what your strengths are and when you should delegate. Mm-hmm. I say is key, whether that's to a contractor, whether that's to an actual team member.
Now, if people want to learn more about you, are there articles or videos or websites where people can go to learn more about Ethan Block?
Yeah, so my main site's just Ethan Block, ethanbloch.com.
And what will people find
there? That's just a landing page that says like, hey, hello, I'm alive. Here's some other places I am on the internet. I keep a blog and I write, you know, 2 to 3 times a week, really simple posts.
Oh, good.
And that's actually the longest, I've been told this is the longest domain name in history. And it's West Coast Tech Meets East Coast Hustle.com. And
there
that's,
you know,
that's
where your blog?
That's my blog. So I share thoughts. I'm somewhat philosophical and just learnings that I have. And I basically write to a younger me, in a sense. Things that I wish I would have known, you know, 5 or 10 years ago.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Baltimore.
So you're a complete transplant.
Oh, yeah.
Do people need to go to San Francisco to sort of drink the Kool-Aid and really feel what's going on at 18th and Guerrero? Or do they need to do that? Or can they do it if they're living in Omaha or St. Petersburg or North Dakota someplace?
Well, the easy answer is no, you don't need to move there. I you know, talk with or meet entrepreneurs starting interesting things all over the world. I just met with some guys last week from South Dakota, mm-hmm. and they're doing something incredible around generating energy. And so I don't think you need to be in San Francisco. For me, it's a lifestyle. I mean, I love the San Francisco is a weird place. And so if you're weird, you feel like you're at home. And I'm weird. And so I wouldn't want to be anywhere else in the world.
Good. Thank you very much, Ethan Block. It's been a treat to get to know you.
Thanks, Nemo.
And to hear your words of wisdom.
Appreciate it.
Signing off.